it's playing the sport for the love of the sport and saying, I want to do what I can to achieve as much as I can in the sport. And again, you don't know until your career is over what that's going to be. So instead of trying to measure, pre-measure where you think it's going to be, just go on the journey and just try to go as far and do as much as you can. And at the end of it, if you do it that way, you will have learned so many life lessons, resilience being the biggest one, because you're going to lose a lot in any sport, no matter who you are. You're going to lose.
Today, I'm joined with a lovely new friend of mine that I've met, I'd say 6 months ago, online and virtually, David Sammel. We went through the Berkeley Executive Coaching Institute together. He's a passionate man, a strong-hearted and heart-filled man, and he stems out of South Africa, but currently is living in England. I don't want to do your bio a disservice, mate, because you know you made it big when you have a Wikipedia page. So I was trying to go through your bio a little bit just to get some context. And I really want to kind of keep the light bulb over your head and let you kind of explain it to us. But just to give everyone a bit of background, a professional tennis player. He works now within the professional tennis game, working close. He's actually in a hotel right now as we record this for the Queen's Open in London. He does executive coaching with athletes and also entrepreneurs and in the executive realm. And he currently is the CEO and owner and founder of the Mindset College. So there's a lot for us to debrief. There's a lot for us to talk about. But welcome, David. Thank you so much for joining.
Thanks a lot for having me. And I'm looking forward to it. And obviously you have a good sporting background as well. So I think we're coming from similar angles and we should have a good discussion.
Yeah, that's what I'm hoping for. And I also found out yesterday that you support United, which I wasn't too happy about. So I made sure that I fit my Liverpool pillow in the background there. Just in case.
Shoot it out.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, in South Africa growing up, there were pretty much only two teams that people mm-hmm. supported, and it was Liverpool or United. And interestingly, we didn't have TV growing up. South Africa only started to get TV in 1978.
Wow.
So we didn't see any football on TV until, 1978. And of course, through the 80s, Liverpool were winning the league and European Cups, mm-hmm. but United were winning the FA Cup a few times and making finals. And the FA Cup was the one game that actually was televised.
Oh, wow.
So, that led to United having a very big following because people initially saw them more than anybody else. So, that's just a little bit of background. So, that's how I became a United fan.
That's fair, because you were a supporter before they were obviously big, because Liverpool was huge in the 80s, like you said, then United kind of took over for the next 20 years in the 90s, early 2000s, and now it's just kind of up for grabs. But at least you were a supporter before they were at their ultimate glory.
Yeah, I think I remember some seasons where I think it was Mark Hughes and McClare. They were winning the league by a considerable margin and mm-hmm. choked really badly the last 3 months. And it was really a tough time. And it seemed like we'd never win the league.
Mm-hmm.
But it's amazing how time it seems to change, because United took was 27 years, I think, before that, between titles.
Mm.
And it seemed like forever. And then Liverpool had, of course, a similar gap.
Mm.
And it just seemed, you know, as an adult to go so much quicker. It didn't seem really that long, but yeah, young growing up, it seemed forever before United won the title again. So bizarre. Man. Anyway,
so talk to us about, you know, your childhood growing up in South Africa. Obviously, you're from South Africa. What, I guess I ask you a better question. What took you from South Africa into, you know, where you are in England, and what brought you out of South Africa?
Well, yeah, I mean, tennis took me out of South Africa. Basically, I played a lot of sport, all different sports, and happened to be very good at cricket as well. Mm. And when I was, this is very ironic, when I was 14, 14, 15, I was kind of very good at tennis and very good at cricket. And my mom and dad sat me down and they said, look, if you play tennis, you can get a scholarship and go to university in America. Mm. If you play cricket, then the only way to make money is you're going to have to go play county cricket in England. Mm. And you just do not want to live in a rubbish country like England. Because, I mean, you know, obviously in the 70s, England was having a lot of problems with strikes and you know, as a country was really struggling. And you know, our parents had traveled there a few times and said it was not a great place to live. And of course, they only had their small snapshot of it. But, you know, they had huge union strikes and, you know, weeks of garbage all over the cities and stuff like that. So it wasn't the only reason I chose tennis, but, you know, America did excite me. And the idea of going on a scholarship to America. So I got a scholarship to the University of Texas. Wow. And I mean, it was the first time I'd ever been out of the country. You know, I remember getting on a big 747 jet and flying to New York. And I get to New York and I couldn't remember. I had to spend one night before I flew to Dallas and then to Austin. And you won't remember this, I don't think, but there was an airline called Braniff. Mm-mm. Which was the old Howard Hughes airline. Wow. And they used to have all different colored airplanes. Yeah, probably a forebearer of Southwest Airlines in a way, you know, quite hip and everything like that. And, you know, I landed in New York, spent the night there. And the first thing that just blew my mind is in those days, there were 25 channels on the TV. Well, in South Africa, we had two channels, and we only had two TV for about, I remember we had from 4 PM till 10 PM was the only time we had TV. So this just blew my mind that you could like get free movies and stuff, and so many channels. So I stayed up way too late watching TV. Mm-hmm. And then the next day, my ticket said BR, you know, 604 flight, and I asked the reception at the hotel, you know, I need to go on the sound. BR, that's British Airways. I thought, oh, that's a bit strange. I don't really know anything. So I go to the British Airways terminal and they're like, no. British Airways don't fly internally in the US. That's Braniff. And of course, JFK, you know, had all these different hubs. Mm. I'm totally in the wrong hub. So I miss my flight. Mm. So I'm in absolute panic and I'm phoning the coach and saying, you know, I'm not going to make, you know, the flight. What are I doing? He said, don't worry. You know, there'll be another Braniff flight. Just get there. So I go to Braniff and of course, you know, it was like, you know, buses, you know, every 2 hours or something, flight to Dallas. So I got on the next flight and then finally landed, got the connection and landed in Austin. And that took me to the States and then, played on scholarship. I did actually transfer because some South African players went to a university called North Texas. Mm-hmm. I transferred out after a year. I didn't really enjoy the coach that much, at Texas. Got recruited by, you know, two of my good friends going to North Texas. In that time, there was a Southwest Conference, and North Texas were pushing to get into it and spending a lot of money. And they guaranteed me a 4-year full scholarship.
Wow.
So I took that and transferred, and we did very well. We were, you know, we were top 25 in the nation, and for a young team, it was very good. Unfortunately for my my senior year, the plug got pulled, the money had been overspent and everything, and we didn't have a coach or anything. So my senior year was pretty poor tennis wise anyway, because the schedule wasn't great and we had no coach. The volleyball coach became the tennis coach, and
wow.
So but I had three very good years there.
Mm-hmm. So from that point you went directly into the pro circuit. What was the next move?
Yeah, I mean, what I did was I look back and I can't remember exactly how we did this, but you know, I'd heard that you can, you know, enter satellite tournaments, which is the start of pro tournaments in Europe, and this is all done by letter. And I found out about, and I went and played pro tennis in Europe during the summer. Mm-hmm. And literally just landed in Holland, and my sister had a friend in The Hague, so I'd written to him and he said, yeah, I'm studying at university, but you can use my apartment. So I just went there, and I remember it was very, very tough first 3 days there. I went to the club and they, you know, and they said, well, you know, you there's no one here to play with. There's no one here for the tournament yet. So I hit against the wall for 3 days and I literally didn't speak to anybody pretty much for 3 days, except, you know, buying food and going out to eat something and ordering stuff. But then started playing pro tennis every summer, realized I could make some money. So I used to come back quite a wealthy student, because I'd play money tournaments in, you know, Holland, Belgium, France, a little bit in Germany, and you know, obviously the pro tour. So I did that every summer. And then when I finished university, I just went out and I realized, because in those days, the States had a lot of big tournaments, but they didn't really have a lot of lower level money tournaments, mm-hmm. Which Europe had. And also Europe had, you know, very sophisticated club league. So I could make money playing for a club in Holland, and basically make money to fund playing the pro tour, because again, in those days you had, you know, very low level satellite tournaments that were for ranking points. And nowadays they have a huge amount of challenges, which is like the middle rung, and then the main tour. Then it was the lower level, very few challenges. So you could basically get to the main pro tour through the lower level, mm-hmm. but it would take a while. And the money was not very good. So you'd save up money at, you know, these, they had professional tournaments all around Europe, but not for world ranking points. So I'd play these for like 6 weeks, you know, make a couple of thousand, $3,000, and then go and blow it all trying to improve my ranking.
Right.
Because these were, you know, very poorly paid. I mean, if you won a low level pro tournament, was like $600, $700. Sheesh. So, you know, if you lost first round, it was like, you know, $30.
Yeah.
It was very poor. So but you know, you learn how to manage money. You learn how to struggle. Mm-hmm. You learn how to, I used to get a URL pass and, you know, travel everywhere by train. And, mm-hmm. I remember it was amazing. You pay like $150 for a URL and you could travel anywhere in Europe on these things.
My favorite part when I first went to England was, taking the chance on getting, you know, taking the train somewhere, but not buying a ticket until they asked you for your ticket. And is how I would get around as many places as I could. There was one time when I was living in Liverpool, but I was on trial with Kidderminster in Birmingham. And it was such a brutal trip because I had to, it wasn't really a straight shot. And I would finish a game and I would have to go all the way back up to Liverpool. And I would make like 50 quid a game. And that would be about what it would cost to get back to Liverpool. So I would just say, you know what, I'm just going to get on the train. And then if they ask me for it, then they ask me for it. And more often than not, David, no one really checked. When they did ask, they said, I would always go, in America, when we're running late, we're allowed to, you know, buy it on the train. Yeah. And then they would say, oh, sorry, not here, you know, type thing. And then I would end up paying them. And then it was the worst would happen when they'd ask me for it, because that'd be like, well, that was my game wage. And then it was gone. But it makes a huge difference in Europe, because you can get so far on train, and the connection system is a lot better than in America. If you don't have a car here, it's very difficult to get around.
Unless you're in America. Well, I mean, when I first went to Holland, the tram system there is an honor system.
Wow.
So I just get on these things I thought was free. Yeah. And it was only after I'd been riding around in these things for a few weeks that somebody said, you know, you actually have to, prepay, these ticket things that, you know, that you just put through there was like a machine and you just stamp it. You know, I'd see these people stamping something, and I thought, well, I guess, because not everybody would stamp, of course. So I thought, well, yeah, I don't know what the story is here, but nobody seems to bother. So I also rode around on the trams a lot for free in Holland.
So yesterday when we spoke also, Dave, you said that you're a little bit of a journeyman. I kind of identify with that too in regards to my playing career. Mm-hmm. So you did a lot of these summer tournaments, trying to make some money, but also trying to get ranked. I know that you were ranked 300 at one point.
And then
walk us through like these next phases. You're out of college and you're pursuing it playing pro. What happened next?
Yeah, I mean, I think, what really happened is I'd keep saving money, going out and playing these satellites and trying to improve my ranking. And then the money would dry up and I'd have to go back and play money tournaments again, which is quite a stressful way of living, because you know, you kind of knew you had to have, you know, between $2,500 and $3,000 put together to go and play a satellite. If you did well in the satellites, which, you know, I did sometimes, you know, you'd come close to maybe breaking even, which would be nice. And then you just roll on to the next satellite. Or maybe take a chance then and have a longer flight and fly back to the States and play satellites there, or, you know, even, you know, back to South Africa at the end of the year, they'd have a satellite. But it was always this balance of, you know, making money and losing money playing the pro tournaments. And then, you know, I then got a really good contract playing for a Dutch club. And started really understanding better how to play tennis, you know, at a higher level. And, you know, start to really think about, well, do I really believe that I can make the jump through satellites, you know, to the top sort of 150? I was ranked high enough to play qualifying for the Grand Slams. I didn't go to Australia because I also had a disadvantage, because in those days South Africa was in the middle of the apartheid era.
Right.
So there were many countries. I mean, I remember I actually got deported from Norway because we were allowed to go to Scandinavia as tourists, but we weren't allowed to play. So I went to Norway, but I entered as an American. After 2 weeks of playing there, they asked to see my passport, and I tried to duck and dive as much as I could, but in the end they came with me to the hotel to see my passport. And while I went to get my passport, the police showed up, and they put me on a train with a policeman and escorted me to the Swedish border. And on the page, deported, which of course wasn't great to have in your passport. So there were a lot of countries I couldn't play. Asia was out. Australia was, you could play, but it was really, really difficult to get the visa. So I kind of had to, and we used to have to get visas for a lot of countries. So like France was a difficult one, because you needed a visa to get into France all the time. And these visas would last like 3 months. And then you'd have to go back to your home country, South Africa, to get another visa, which was just financially not possible. So, I got escorted out of France a couple of times, but you'd go to, just drive through and country border posts and not get stopped. So I did play quite a bit in France, but it was always nerve-wracking getting in. And then you could play in Germany and obviously the UK and the Benelux countries, which was Luxembourg, Belgium and Holland. I needed a visa, but I could get the visa in London. So I had to kind of had this range of places to play in. Spain was another one I could play. Gotcha. and Portugal. I decided, once I started playing, for a couple of years for this Dutch club, which was the mainstay, and I was getting pretty well paid for that. And then traveling around and blowing all this cash on the pro tour, trying to get my ranking up, I just thought, what is a professional tennis player? Well, it's somebody who makes a living at it. Now, if I want to rent an apartment and have my own place and stuff like that, I can't keep blowing the money that I'm making on trying to get my ranking up. So do I really believe I can make the top 100 in the world? And how long would it take me? And I came to the decision that I wasn't convinced that I could. The other thing was, I didn't have the money to pay for a coach or anything to travel with me in any way. Though, to be fair, in those days, not that many players had that, but certainly a lot of the better players did have some help. So I decided to really just make money playing tennis. So then I concentrated on club tennis and money tournaments and made a living basically playing tennis that way.
Okay.
So, that's why I say, journeyman, and that's not an insult to anybody, because you're still a good level. You're not playing in the major tournaments of the world, apart from qualifying and not quite, you're not getting yourself on TV very much.
Yeah.
So, right.
So now you kind of gave us a great transition there. So you went to Holland. You're now working with at a club level. You're still playing money tournaments. So you're not quite working on your ranking, but at least you're making some income. Does now come the course direct? I mean, at what point now was it like, okay, it's time to put down the pursuit of playing pro and start to, a door seems to have opened for you.
It was. I remember actually I was playing a satellite in the Canary Islands, which was for ranking points. And I was actually doing okay on this one. And I got a phone call. I got a message at the hotel from a friend of mine at the Dutch club. And he said the head coach had quit to go work for the Federation. Mm-hmm. Would I be interested in the head coach job for the Dutch club? I said, well, you know, I still want to play. He said, well, you know, I've spoken to the committee and everything, that they'll allow you time to play pro tournaments. You're going to play for the club, and you're here, you know, for pretty much 6 to 7 weeks anyway, depending if we make playoffs or not. And, you know, we just would like you to be here for 12 weeks of the summer and coach the first three teams and play for the first team as well. And, you know, he made me a decent offer, which for me at that time was like, wow, you know, that's pretty good. And, you know, they said I didn't have to do a lot of individual lessons as long as I took care of the teams. So I said yes to that. And so I started, you know, coaching the first three teams, playing myself. And then, you know, the odd person would ask me for a private lesson. And it, you know, with the money tournaments that I was playing, with the level that I was at, I didn't have to start playing till Thursday or Friday. And sometimes just play one match in the evening. And then, you know, maybe a match on the Saturday and a final on the Sunday, or, you know, sometimes just one match on Friday and two on Saturday, and the tournament would be done. And you could make, you know, $1,000 for that, or, you know, $1,500 for that. So, I'd do that a lot, but I had sort of, you know, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday to practice and time on my hands. So I started giving some private lessons, and that was more money, of course. And quite a lot of the private lessons then were quite nice. They were decent players who were almost just paid to play against me, because it was exciting to, you know, to hit with me and play with against me. And then, you know, and then some of the better juniors, you know, the parents would pay for them to practice with me. So it started to get very mixed, because I was making a lot of money as a teaching pro plus playing. And then the first year that I did that, you know, I actually, you know, went back to the UK with, you know, about $35,000 cash in hand, which was a lot of money then. And my wife was an air stewardess, and she would take 3 months unpaid leave, and then I would go and play the tour, and she'd travel with me. So I did that after the first year. The second year, I knew I was going to come back with all this money, and I discussed it with my wife. Do I really want to go? I mean, because obviously with the two of us traveling, we then I was picking some nice satellites to go play, like Hawaii and and South Africa, you know, and you know, we were having some, you know, great times while I was playing as well. But it was costing money, you know. I wasn't making money. After the second year of doing this, I decided to play money tournaments in England. And they also had this new league that they started in England. And I was asked to captain the Manchester team, which was like a team tennis thing, which was also good money. And so suddenly, you know, there's money coming in from all these different angles. And then the Lawn Tennis Association asked me if I would help some of the better juniors in the northwest of England. So I did that two evenings a week as well. Then going back for my third year, one of the girls at the club was developing very well into a good pro. So her father asked me if I would do some travel to international tournaments with her. So I started to do some of that. And then the Lawn Tennis Association asked me if I would do some travel with some of the better juniors in Britain. So it was starting to get really difficult for me to even, you know, find time to play for myself.
Right.
So I'd say I kind of just eased out of playing and into the coaching that way. And whilst I still played tournaments, you know, into my, you know, mid to late 30s, it got less and less. Mm-hmm. And I found myself having to travel with more players and you know, being asked to do more coaching. And the Dutch club that I played for didn't have any indoor courts, so it was only a summer job. And they failed in their attempt to get indoor courts. So I got offered a head coach job in Manchester, which was all year round because they had, you know, eight indoor courts. And I decided then to do that. The Dutch girl came over and started to train with me there, which was obviously very attractive for all the best players in the Northwest. And I started a sort of like a mini academy of six players and started doing a lot of work with them. And I'd still play against them quite a lot as well. So I was keeping my eye in that way. But it became more and more coaching role. So that's really how I transitioned.
Wow. Okay. So obviously tennis was that amazing vehicle for you, and it got to a point where there was, let's say, it was just too hard for you to do both. Right. And there was that decision. When it came to that decision, it sounded like it was a bit of a transition, but was there any inner dialect or inner conflict about not letting go of playing?
Yeah. It was actually, I became a British citizen, so I was able to play the Cheshire County Championships and I won those. And the Dutch girl and some of the better kids that were, you know, that I was coaching, I went around and played some tournaments with them, and was starting to, you know, win because I was playing a little bit more regular at this little period, win quite a bit. And I remember being very tempted to say, chuck in all the coaching. You know, I had some, you know, really decent money behind me now, and maybe give it a full go on the pro tour. But of course, by then I'd lost my ranking. So I would have had to start right at the bottom again. And it caused me a few sleepless nights for sure. And discussed it a lot, you know, with my wife, and I think the deciding factor was, I did kind of deep down know that it's one thing playing tournaments for fun. Yes, it's for money, but it's, you know, and it's another thing playing for ranking. And also, I had the coaching in between. I was helping the kids. And so if you then transition back to the pro tour, it is week in and week out, and you know, and that's a different feeling to kind of playing, you know, a few in a row and then, you know, taking some time to coach kids. And so I thought, really and truthfully, you know, was I certain that I could put in literally 2 years of focused just tennis, and how would I feel if it didn't go well, and, you know, I'd kind of blown all our security money and had to start. Not that it would be a big deal, but, you know, it was a fact. I was married now, you know, and so you know, we had bought a house, and so there were responsibilities there as well. And whilst, you know, my wife was working, we would have managed. I thought, well, I had to believe 100% that that I could make top 100. And I couldn't convince myself that I could do that. So once I'd made that decision, then the transition happened a lot faster. And I actually pretty much played very little in terms of tournaments after that. So,
that's powerful, because I think that, I mean, that road comes in every athlete's life, right? At what point do I say yes? What point do I say no? So now, you know, let's fast forward now to present day. You're working as a coach in the traditional sense with a tennis player. You're obviously traveling right now. Mm-hmm. You've also have an executive coaching business. You work with people, also other athletes, but you also work in the business sphere and other industries. And you just recently launched a coaching and a mentorship program, we should call it, in regards to Mindset College. So debrief that a little bit for us so we know what Mindset College is.
Yeah, I think when I started coaching, mm-hmm. I don't want to say it was hardship, because it was difficult because I felt that had I had some help with my tennis, I could have done a lot better, because it took me too long to work it out. And there were holes in my game that could have been fixed had I known how to. And that obviously meant that, you know, I can look back at some, you know, matches that could have made a difference that I lost, close matches in at different times, that would have been a quick, a jump in ranking. So I'd play like a 250 tournament, like they call them today, which is a higher level pro tournament, play qualifying, mm-hmm. and get to the last round of qualifying. And, you know, I remember one in Hilversum, this was in Holland, and I lost to a guy who was, you know, 90 in the world in a very, very close match. Mm-hmm. And then in Manchester, I lost to, another top 100 player, you know, 11-9 in the third set. And there were just a few little, you know, either mental mistakes or just, you know, game management mistakes that lost me these matches, which had I won them, you know, would have meant a bigger clump of points, which takes your ranking up a lot faster. I no one match makes or breaks a career, that's for sure. And no five matches makes or breaks a career, but there are matches that can make confidence wise and everything that can give you a lot of momentum. And if you don't win them, it can really hurt. So when I started coaching, the thing I really wanted to impart more than anything was knowledge that I'd gained through the struggles to help younger players not make all the same mistakes that I made, you know, and to help them with some of the struggles that I'd actually worked out over, you know, 10 years of playing. And so that was the driving force behind it. And then, of course, coaching very quickly on the pro tour at a high level, and with players that went way higher than I had played at, you learn a hell of a lot. And then you start to mix with people at higher levels and learn even more. And so the success that I had with players, and getting players to perform on big stages in the world, really started to foment in my ideas in my head of how you can reach more than just the few players that you're going to touch. So my first project was to write the book Locker Room Power. Mm-hmm. Now, Locker Room Power was something that I always knew existed, and everybody kind of knows exists, which is the aura on top of the reality. You know, the way I explain it is, say Ronaldo's going to take a free kick, mm-hmm. you know, or Messi. And how the defense feeling? They're going to be nervous. The goalie's going to be a little nervous. And I believe that these nerves affect how fast they react because of who is taking the free kick. So if Ronaldo hits a fantastic free kick into the top corner, but the goalie just manages to get a glove but can't keep it out. And then, you know, Joe Bloggs hits the same ball exactly the same way, but because it's Joe Bloggs, it's like, you know, I can save this. And the guy's instinctive, and that ball is deflected over the bar. That's what I call locker room power. So, you know, all the best athletes in the world, you know, and even in business, they have an aura about them that, you know, puts fear in opponents and therefore gives them an advantage. And that's locker room power. And locker room power is powerful both ways. If you're aware of it, you also then have the antidote to it, which is not to fall for locker room power, which is very difficult not to, because of course these people have locker room power because they're good as well. So I devised a formula, which was, desire plus belief plus two weapons plus success equals locker room power.
So break those down for us. Desire.
So desire, you have to have the desire, you know, to want to do, you know, the desire is really wanting to do the hard yards and doing the hard yards consistently, and understanding that they just have to be done no matter how painful it gets. Mm-hmm. Belief is, I think, as we all know, very, very powerful. But I think separating confidence from belief is really important. Because you can believe that you're going to be a top player, but when you lose confidence, do you still have belief? And the way you can understand this is, you know, if a top athlete gets injured and they're out for a year, when they come back, they don't panic and think, oh my goodness, you know, am I going to only be able to, you know, am I going to be able to make the reserves, you know, will I be able to, you know, play, you know, in the first team ever again? Mm-hmm. You know, they don't have any doubt. They don't come back to, you know, with and even if they're not going to have a lot of confidence when they first start back, mm-hmm. but the belief is 100%, I'm going to be back in the first team. I know that. I just have to get the confidence and the playing time to be able to do that. Whereas somebody who gets to the first team on a wave of confidence but doesn't really believe, mm-hmm. and they get injured, they will come back panicked that mm-hmm. they're not actually good enough to be there. So belief and confidence are two. You know, everybody has periods of more confidence than others. So I say that belief is like a stone wall, and confidence is like sand that blows in and out, you know, and when you've got a lot of sand on top of your wall, you're flying. But when that sand blows out, you know, you've still got a foundation, you know, a level that you're not going to really go below. Mm-hmm. Whereas if your whole wall is kind of, you know, sand with kind of drying sand underneath, you know, and a big wind comes through and it blows the whole wall down. You're starting almost at a very low base again every time you lose confidence. And that's, I think, the difference between people who have belief is no matter how bad things get, they always know that they actually belong at a level. Hmm. And people who don't have that belief, when they lose confidence, don't know what level they belong at. I don't know if that makes sense.
That makes plenty of sense.
And then I say, you know, then a minimum of two weapons. You've got to have two things in whatever you do, you know, unique selling points in two things that you do really, really well that people either respect you or fear you for. Some very gifted people have more than two things, but these are what I call weapons. And all great people are remembered for the things they do well. They're not remembered for the things they do badly. Mm-hmm. You know, everybody has strengths and weaknesses. But the best competitors do focus on their strengths and make sure that they deliver their strengths. And therefore, if they do, they get success. And with that, they then have locker room power.
Hmm. So walk me through it again. Desire, belief.
Right. Desire plus belief plus a minimum of two weapons, two strengths,
mm-hmm.
plus success equals locker room power.
Wow.
And, you would always know in tennis the alpha male of the tournament.
Mm.
Now, the alpha male could either be somebody who was genuinely really good or somebody who was doing really well on a wave of confidence.
Right.
And then, 3 weeks later, you're saying, how did they win that tournament? They can hardly play today.
Yeah.
But then you have the genuine champions, have locker room power and everybody knows in the locker room that they're the ones to beat or the one to beat. That's why, the amazing thing of great players, the consistency they have is based on locker room power, because it's very difficult to beat another good player who really believes they can beat you.
Mm-hmm.
So let's take any tournament, but let's take a tennis tournament, a Grand Slam. You have to win 7 matches to win that tournament. If every single person you play believes in the bottom of their heart that they can beat you, and the margins are not big, you're going to have dogfight after dogfight after dogfight. And that is incredibly tiring.
Mm.
You're probably not going to have the legs by the time you get to the semis or the finals. But when you have locker room power, people might say they believe they're going to beat you, but after the first set and they lose at 7-6 and then it's still tough, they'll fade away and just lose belief.
Mm.
So the best players conserve a lot of energy because people either lose to them before they even step on the court, or quite quickly in the match are persuaded that they can't do it that day.
Mm.
And so they conserve huge amounts of energy. So they play their best at the end of the tournament because, they've maybe had, 3 really tough battles to get there. And, maybe the other guy is new on the scene and had, 6 battles to get there or 5 battles. And again, that fatigue sets in, mental and physical. So locker room power allows you to win matches without putting out maximum energy,
mm.
or putting out maximum energy, but not having to do it for too long.
Right. Okay. So locker room power was the kind of the preface to Mindset College. And you spoke a little bit about how you looked back at your career and there was points and kind of gaps that you could, that you saw in hindsight, but that you would like to fill. And you said something also interesting, like I would like to help an athlete not make as many of the mistakes as I made, because that's kind of part of the process you've accepted, and as athletes we've accepted as well. So what do you think a major gap is to be filled in the industry itself today? What are you really passionate about helping these athletes with?
I mean, there's a number of things, and the reason I created Mindset College is because becoming a well-rounded person and a top athlete is a real ecosystem of feelings and emotions and understanding how you manage all of this. I think one of the big messages I really do want to get across is I think so many young people have the idea that once you make it, life's going to be great and your problems go away and, you know, it's much easier. Well, the formula doesn't change. Every level, to go up a level, you have to put in more work and you got to get better. And if you think about it, when you first start off and you put in, you know, 20 hours of work, you get a lot of improvement because you're starting from a low base. But the higher you get, the smaller the margins are. So 20 hours work means almost nothing in terms of improvement at a very high level. You know, and the biggest jump you're ever going to make really is from 2 to 1. Because that's the smallest margin, you know. And so you might have to put in 500 hours work to improve one small subtlety in your game to make the difference and start, you know, winning, you know, to become number one in the world. So it's to get rid of that myth that somehow you know, the higher you get, the easier it gets. No, the higher you get, the harder it gets. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, as you evolve to a higher and higher level, you become more robust. You evolve as a person. You're able to handle more and more pressure. So, you know, if you're going to lift 100 kilos in the gym, say, you know, bench press, and you start, you know, you start training out at you know, 30 kilos, you're going to improve pretty quickly. But once you start getting to, you know, 85, 90, those improvements are going to be very, very hard to come by, you know. And the more weight you do, the harder and harder it is, and the longer and longer you're going to have to work to just get those little incremental improvements. And that's really what sport is. However, you know, you can handle 85 kilos pretty well. It's still 85 kilos and heavy, but your body has changed and you can handle it. So it's not, whilst it's still heavy, it's not that heavy to you. You know, and so it's that evolvement both mentally and physically that happens, which allows you to cope. But the person who's lifting, you know, 50 kilos is looking at that and thinking it's impossible. And it is impossible for them. But keep improving. And, you know, by the time you get to 80 kilos, then 85 becomes very realistic. So, you know, belief also is built on doing the work and having these improvements and understanding. If you just focus on getting better, eventually look back and go, wow, I've come a long way. So it's really important that people know what they're getting into. You know, it's the same as, you know, if you have a business that's, you know, $1 million business, people think, oh, that's wonderful. Well, there's headaches that come with that, but the headaches aren't as big as the $10 million business or the $100 million business. They come with far bigger headaches. Yes, you know, And part of this and part of the course is also talking about problem machines. You know, life is a problem machine, but you wake up in the morning and life throws you problems. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're an athlete, your sport throws you problems. Every day you wake up, problems come. And you can't live in this fantasy world that if you get to a certain level, those problems, that machine suddenly turns off. Mm-hmm. That machine never, ever turns off. It's always going to be throwing you problems. So why not say, actually, okay, I know problems are coming my way, so I'm a problem solver. I've got another machine in me that's just here to solve problems. Mm-hmm. And actually, human beings like solving problems. Otherwise, why did people do puzzles, Sudoku, you know, computer games? All of these things are to solve problems. So we actually are built to solve problems, but suddenly we get good at something and want a bigger prize, and we want the problems to all go away. Mm-hmm. No, remember that we actually like problems, you know, and sometimes, of course, the problems can overwhelm you, but you know what, if you just chip away at them, you get them back under control again.
Yeah.
So I don't know if this is making sense to you, but
it does. So, well, let me ask you this. So obviously, one of the needs that you see to be filled is to kind of get rid of this dreamland where once you've made it, quote unquote, that's it, you can kick your feet up. So how do you help prepare? How do you help change that process, or they change that picture for these athletes so that they see it as a continual growth pattern instead of a destination to get to? What is it that you help them work through?
Well, I think awareness is the number one thing. So mm-hmm. first thing, you got to give people awareness. And I do that mostly through stories, mm-hmm. like I've just given, or analogies, you know, like the gym analogy. You know, people can start to get around, well, yeah, if I was, you know, to go and, you know, from 98 kilos to 100, that was a pretty tough trip, you know, and from 100 to 105 took me 6 months, right. You know. So I think being aware that this is how it works is a big part of it. You know, the other thing is, if you just look at stats in sport, you know, nobody wins everything. And also, you know, with young players, I will ask them this and say, you know, would you like to win every match you play? Yes. Really? Okay. So would you like to be responsible for killing the sport? We go, what are you talking about? Well, think about it. If you never lost a match, it'd be very exciting for a couple of years until you became number one in the world. And then you never lost a match. Why would people go and watch the sport anymore? Because they know exactly who's going to win. So nobody goes and watches the sport. Nobody wants to sponsor a sport. There's no excitement because they know who's going to win. You kill the sport. I'm like, ah, you know, the whole nature of sport is that beautiful balance that nobody, there are some dream athletes that win a hell of a lot. Mm-hmm. But it's never guaranteed. Mm-hmm. And that's the beauty of it. For them, for the challengers, it's never guaranteed. You know, you can get odds on favorites and they win a lot of the time, but then the upset happens. And it's always the uncertainty that can happen that makes people want to go watch sport. And why it's so intriguing. And then, of course, you then get to life, which is why life is so intriguing, because, you know, people don't always realize what they're asking for. But, you know, if you were given the choice to know your future 100%, would you take it?
Honestly, probably not.
No, when you really consider that question, mm-hmm. because that will kill your life. Because you know exactly what's going to happen. Mm. And And if it's not what you in your mind think might happen, and it's totally different and not as acceptable as you would like it to be, then you're living a life that, you know, that's going down an avenue that you just don't want to go down. Mm-hmm. Or if it's better than you thought it was going to be, you're going to be disappointed because everything's going to be just turning out this wonderful thing. And, you know, every struggle is not uncertainty anymore because you know where your destination is, you know, and also how we, you know, if you live and you know the future and the future's ending in 1 year, you know, how are you going to live that year? You know, whereas, you know, the uncertainty about life is actually the nectar of life. It's what makes it so exciting to live. And the adventure is, you know, every day we wake up, we don't know for sure what's going to happen that day. Mm. You know, we think we do, but really we don't. And the same goes for sport. So don't try and you know, don't try and solve every problem immediately and try to get problems out of your life so it's going to be this free reign, because it never will be. You know, the problems will come up, and if things are going you know, amazingly well and you don't have any challenges for a while, you know what, people get bored, and when people are bored, they do silly things.
It's true.
So you need to challenge yourself then.
Yeah, no, you gave me a great transition there, because, you know, the idea of this podcast is to see how someone has used the vehicle of sports more or less and driven with it and kind of allowed it to open up doors and be open to outcome and possibilities and of that nature. You've captured that perfectly in your career and where that's been. And, you know, we had a chat yesterday and you said a great line. I had to write it down. And it said, "I don't really know a starving ex-athlete." And I want to preface that, obviously, there's a lot of mental health, you know, talks right now. And there's, you know, people that maybe go down the alcohol route or drug abuse and things of that nature. But someone that maybe has, you know, their head screwed on tight and are on the straight and narrow. If you could say quickly to athletes that are listening, that how to maximize the opportunity that they have by pursuing it at 100%, the importance of that because of the overarching end of where that might lead them. How important is that?
Extremely important. It's
Thanks for listening to another Cool Down Conversations episode. Through testimony and interviews, Cool Down Conversations is geared to help equip this next generation for a more purposeful, heart-filled, and passionate career. If you like this episode, please feel free to share with friends and family. And if you have any questions at all, don't ever hesitate to reach out at PaxtonBallardINC@gmail.com. Yup. Yeah.